This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In this program, you will get a quick update on the most dangerous moment for humanity since the Cuban Missile Crisis. That is developing in Reactor 4 at Fukushima, Japan. Then we'll get to some dirty business. What happens if all of you, and millions more people, realize we have to grow food in the cities? City soil is already poisoned by toxic chemicals. Will we strip off surrounding farms to sell bags of dirt at Home Depot and Walmart? Our main speaker this week is Nancy Clem from the Bioneers 2013 Chicago Great Lakes Conference. Nancy takes soil activism to a whole new level, diving into dumpsters for bags of goo that can become fertile soil. She's into bioremediation. Why is it illegal in some places? Along the way, I'm going to take time for two great green songs. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
Here is the latest from the crippled nuclear reactors at Fukushima Daiichi in Japan. A robotic survey at Fukushima Reactor No. 1 showed what everyone already knows: highly radioactive water is leaking from the containment vessel to the reactor floor in the basement. One of the few sources of information is a visiting professor at Hosei University named Horisho Miyano. He says these parts may have been dislodged in the hydrogen explosion at Reactor 1 in March 2011. That indicates severe damage occurred to the reactor, he says. Miyano went on to say the same level of damage and radioactive leaks can be expected at reactors 2 and 3, which also exploded. The operator, Tokyo Electric Power Company, did not release an estimate of the amount of radioactive materials leaking from these three reactors. And now we come to what has been called the dangerous moment at reactor number 4. At reactor 4, the delicate operation to remove uranium and plutonium in fuel rods perched high atop the damaged building has not begun yet, as far as I can tell. Last week, TEPCO and the government announced a delay of 2 weeks to do further risk assessments and a trial run. We don't know when this dangerous work will begin. Other governments are pressuring Japan to get the nuclear fuel out of Reactor 4 before a major earthquake, which are common in that region, can crash the building or cut off the water cooling supply. A popular article in Washington's blog claims attempts to remove reactor fuel is the most dangerous moment for humanity since the Cuban Missile Crisis in the 1960s. I agree, but this moment will drag on for at least a year, possibly several years. After the press has become bored with this story and with this project, the ultimate danger of a large nuclear reaction remains. The TEPCO fuel removal plan is only slightly less risky than I feared. Each bundle would be lifted by a remote-operated crane and hopefully placed within a casket, with the whole operation done underwater. If successful, the casket would be sealed, hauled out by a different crane, and trucked to another ground-level fuel pool on the site. That pond is already overburdened with nuclear fuel from years of operating the plant, but it's better than sitting on top of a damaged building. At Reactor 4, the Japanese have not explained what will happen if one of these fuel bundles contains loose or damaged rods, which could come in contact with one another. TEPCO has removed the visible debris that fell into the fuel pool, which included, by the way, the building roof and a giant industrial crane. What really counts, though, is what fell into the nuclear fuel bundles themselves. That remains. And what if rods damaged by debris drop extremely radioactive pellets on the fuel pool floor or deep within the casings? Were the fuel bundles damaged in the major explosion in Reactor Building 4? What if adjacent fuel rods come into direct contact with one another during the operation? Some experts fear a nuclear reaction is possible. That could mean the whole Fukushima site would have to be evacuated, but then who would run the daily cooling pumps at the other reactors required to keep all that leaking radioactive water from heading into the Pacific? Preventing an even greater nuclear disaster for both Japan and the Pacific Ocean requires many workers on site daily. One false step could take the radioactivity beyond the limits of human survival. Could a nuclear explosion shoot more radioactive particles high into the atmosphere to fall on North America and the whole northern hemisphere? It's certain the Pacific Ocean would get another burst of radiation. if distributed, there is enough nuclear material in reactor 4 alone in that fuel pool to poison the entire northern hemisphere, and there's plenty more nuclear fuel balanced in the roof of the damaged reactor building 3. That building is seldom discussed in the press or public because that whole building is too radioactive to be approached even by robots. Reactor 3 was running a special super plutonium blend called MOX when it exploded. Nuclear fuel remains in reactors 1 and 2 as well. The Fukushima nuclear accident is far from over. Regular listeners know the million-dollar oceanfront properties of the wealthy are due for a rude wave of storms and rising seas. Vancouver songwriter Jeff Berner is on the case with this observation. In more ways than one, the rich are going to move to the higher ground. Jeff was recorded outdoors in downtown Vancouver beside a chain-link fence and a sign saying, Habitat Closed.
Wealthy people like to live near the water. They'll pass their real estate down to their sons and their daughters. Generations of happy, just enjoying the view. But when the water starts rising, you know what they're gonna do. The rich are gonna move to the high ground. The rich are gonna move to the high ground. Holy doodle, look at your town. The rich are gonna move to the high ground. All those singers and actors and philanthropists say the poor are at the top of their priority list. But when the levees start breaking and the barriers fall, where will they be when we come to pay a courtesy call? With their mistresses, wives, pets, children and all, at the top of a hill behind a fortified wall. Cause the rich are gonna move to the high ground. The rich are gonna move to the high ground. Holy doodle, look at your town. The rich are gonna move to the high ground. Every sad number that the scientists find, you get the feeling that some people really don't mind to see a new feudal age for the whole human race. Cause the rabble will finally be all back in their place. There'll be no revolution, we'll be meek as wet mouses, begging them to let our children serving their houses. Cause the rich are gonna move to the high ground. The rich are gonna move to the high ground. Holy doodle, look at your town. The rich are gonna move to the high ground. Take me higher to that higher ground. You and me, baby, we're gonna watch the poor drown. Cause the rich are gonna move to the high ground. The rich are gonna move to the high ground. Holy doodle, look at your town. The rich are gonna move to the high ground.
That was Vancouver's Jeff Berner, recorded by Matt Côté for his upcoming film, A Date with Ed. Find it on YouTube or in my show blog at ecoshock.info. As promised, here is Nancy Clem on bioremediation in the cities. She tells us how to read our surroundings. We also learn about plants that soak up radiation, a good thing to know in Fukushima times. Nancy is about compost as an act of revolution. She's a landscape designer, horticultural consultant, and permaculture expert. But mostly, I think Nancy is a social activist who isn't afraid to get her hands dirty. This recording was made by Kelly Pierce of the Chicago Independent Media Center for Radio EcoShock. It was at the Bioneers 2013 conference at the start of November. Now, normally you'll find a formal introduction and all that. Instead, Nancy found herself in a room with no microphone after leaving a breakout session on direct action. There, the Reverend Billy of the Church of Stop Shopping fled the room, hoping to avoid being arrested. That's where we come in.
Okay, I just want to take a moment that Reverend Billy was probably arrested. And he came into that direct action talk, and he was there, and then he was escorted out because the police were coming. I just want to let you all know.
So was it strictly around breaking up the machine?
Problem being that he's already has something else against him, so it could get really bad. It was pretty emotional. Like, everybody in there has, most people in that room had rested or been arrested, and most people have been, or they're wondering where they are in that. And when someone came in to get him, Lan said, "Is everything okay?" And Billy said, "Probably not. I'm going to try to catch that F train. I'll see if he can get it next time." So anyway, it was a pretty emotional moment. Well, at least it was. I mean, it was for people in that room. It was hard.
But, I mean, that workshop was on nonviolent change.
Nonviolent direct action.
It was a good model.
Yeah, that was our discussion. Is it violent to destroy a piece of plastic? It's all in question. So anyway, it could have been really rich in there. I wish I didn't have this talk, because I would have liked to hang out a little further. But anyway, that's kind of what's up right now. It might destroy a relationship with RU. Who knows? Anyway, to start with that, I'm going to introduce myself. And can everybody hear me? You in the back? This is for his recording. This is Kelly Pierce of a radio show called Eco Shock. But I don't have no one's like hooked me up to a recording. So I'm pretty loud. So I think I can probably stretch. But you in the very back. Yeah, if you need to come forward, please feel free. Anyway, I'll just introduce myself. My name is Nancy Clem, and I do direct action also, nonviolent, but then sometimes it might be in a question. But like recently, it's kind of amazing what environmentalists, when you're trying to obey natural law and be loyal to place, really embrace the city as habitat, you find yourself at odds with a lot of things that you're being told are illegal. So I do a lot of work around soil fertility and around water, clean water. And when I talk about work, I'm talking about really physical, down and dirty work. And I train other people to do that work. And so I run a small L3C business called Social Ecologies. And Social Ecologies is really committed to training people who can further spread this work. So I mostly work with community groups and small groupings of individuals, organizations. I was recently out in Estancia, New Mexico, working for the 13th Council of 13 Grandmothers. Some of you might have heard about it. So I was hanging out with a bunch of indigenous grandmothers, helping them with a seed vault they had just built out in Estancia, New Mexico. In fact, there's a whole new generation of seed banks starting that are really based in place and based in really, really strong communities. The other one that started about an hour's drive away is in Española, which is the old capital of the United States, which is now one of the big heroin centers of the Southwest. And Española just had their last indigenous seed conference. But there's a new seed vault there, too. And it's held by Tusuke Pueblo people. I just came from a place where there's a very grounded, very place-based action. And I sometimes wonder if the problem in the city, because I've been doing this for like 23 years, like ever since I came to the city, I do come from a big rural, I have a rural background. People don't realize that city is your habitat. It's not just a place where you dump your clothes and dates and go see movies and whatever people are doing. You know, it's like we actually live here, and we actually are dependent on the biological infrastructure of the city. We're dependent on Lake Michigan and the Chicago River and the air we breathe and all those kinds of things. And maybe I understand that a little bit more acutely because I come from a rural area. And maybe I understand that a little bit more acutely because I live in Little Village, and I have for 15 years. And I always think of these poor communities are the people who see it faster. You can't not see it when you live in an area like that. So want to talk about, you are here right now, here And if you don't know about your watershed or you don't know what your soils are like here, I think, you know, start exploring that and start understanding that. We talk about, what are we going to do about fracking? Well, this might be what you might want to learn how to do. If anything happens, it's like good emergency homework. You want to start it now as opposed to 10 years from now. And I think the other guiding principle that I really want you to remind you of is, as above, so below. So this is Hermes, thrice Hermes, Hermes Trismegistus, something like that. I always stumble upon his name, but it was Hermes thrice Hermes, and he's the one who was a green hermeticist, and he was as above, so below. So what we see above ground is probably going below ground. So if we're as kind of polluted and crazy and sick as a society, guess what our earth is? Probably the same thing. Just like what's below feeds above, what's above feeds below. So we actually feed into our landscape as much as we feed off of our landscape. This is not unidirectional. This is dual directionality, and this is a very, very old idea, and I still feel like it's important to bring up because I think we've forgotten it. And the Archdruid is here. Yes. So, what is this goldenrod plant doing on Ashland and Webster? Because I remember this exact one from 3 years ago. What is this goldenrod doing besides growing? Anybody? It's expressing its life, right? Great. It's breaking the concrete, yeah. It's thriving, yeah. And it's doing pretty good for its compromised position because goldenrod's pretty tenacious. It can do pretty well, but it would be taller and bushier maybe if it got more water, had a better condition. But let's look a little closer. What is that goldenrod doing? It's creating its own soil. It's actually healing that exact position in Chicago. So it's creating its own soil. It's healing that position. And it creates its own soil not only through its action in its roots and catching water, but just creating that clump. It's catching all sorts of debris, plastic, organic, otherwise, and it's collecting around that plant, and it's building a little island, little biological island. And these give me great hope. So this is the landscape actually healing itself on Ashland and Webster on the bridge. And there's some friends down the way. You can see them popping through. Like, I've been in the food movement for a really long time. And then when all these people start getting involved in the food movement, I'm like, great. I'm going to continue doing my foraging. I'm going to continue doing my food work. But I'm not going to talk about it anymore because the kids are taking it over and I don't have to do it anymore. I'm going to take the next thing. The next thing that I feel like we need to go at and soil. So this is somewhere behind like UIC, I think, somewhere. It almost doesn't matter because we see this all the time. And what we see is a very, very disturbed landscape, disturbed in the sense the soil's been disturbed, it's been compacted under machinery. And because of that, the rain can't absorb back into the soil because the soil's collapsed. So soil is, a healthy soil is a spongy, beautiful spongy mass that can receive rain. It's very receptive to rain. It can hold on to that moisture. In this case, it's just like a mud slick. And so once this becomes a building, there'll be some small footprint. And as someone who I was an ecological landscaper and ran an ecological landscaping business for 17 years, the landscaper's coming at the end, and we have to make something thrive there. And so you bring in as much soil as you're able to, or as much as they're going to pay for, and then you build on top of this kind of almost impermeable surface, and then people wonder why the trees aren't thriving or the shrubs are too small, or why is it getting waterlogged when it's been, well, your sprinklers aren't so much, but there's no decent drainage. This is essentially what I would call paved. This is essentially relaxed like a paved environment. And since 80% or so of our cities are paved, are impenetrable to rain, this is why we look at stormwater as a problem as opposed to a gift. Water is a gift always. Stormwater is not a problem. Grab it. They do it in Tucson. We can do it here, you guys, but it does probably allow a call for some illegal activity. And as I learned in the last panel, don't do the crime unless you're willing to do the time. So you got to figure out what you want to do. So mostly what I do is educate, and I do it on site. So I just wanted to talk, first of all, we are talking about bioremediation, because back in 2004, Aaron Dernbaugh, who was the deputy director of the Department of Environment, which is what it was called at the time, declared soils, city soils, as being completely contaminated and not safe to grow in. And now he's the sustainability chief of Loyola. And I get, every time I see him, like, you know, you run into somebody like that in like Trader Joe's, and you just go, so how's it going, Aaron? You know, making any changes? And so we just give each other a hard time about what we're doing. He's like, have you been arrested yet? Or I see you're really dirty. And, you know, anyway. But given that, then soil is something that we have to buy. And where are we buying it from? Well, we probably bought it from like one of many places. My family farm that was sold, that I had in my family since the 1850s. It was sold, stripped, pulverized, or probably cooked, pasteurized, pulverized, and then it's kind of being sold back in bags to us at Home Depot. So this idea that we buy in soil when we start a community garden, because urban people want to grow a couple of tomatoes, they buy, you know, bring in 3,000 pounds of soil of a cost of $1,500 or something so they can grow a couple of tomato plants because they want to be connected to their local food. You know, it really doesn't make sense. So I really want to talk about bioremediation, or re-embracing our cities as habitats, yes, changing our perception in that, and then to ourselves, to our place, to each other, our plants, our soil, our water. And it's a social justice, and it's an ecological healing. It's many things, but I really think the biggest hurdle in urban areas, I work in a lot of urban areas, I work in LA all the time, and it's just like, the bioremediation we need to do is actually on our own, like, heart, heads, and souls. I mean, it's really, you guys excluded, but really, this is the constant education piece that I have to come back to. So there's certain tools of bioremediation, and one of them is micro remediation, is working with microbes, working with bacteria. So we can do compost more intently on a larger scale than we already do, because everybody has their little backyard piles, their little composters, everybody in their own little, every 25 feet, the next yard, every 25 feet, the next yard. I mean, I grew up on 500 acres. I mean, forget this boutiquing of land. I mean, like, this is, think expanses, think neighborhoods, think community-wide, think across town, think bigger. I'm not good at thinking small. It's probably because I grew up on a farm, and because nothing was small, everything was big. But we need to make it bigger, and there's some certain ordinances right now that are in place that disallow us from doing that, so it is illegal. But there is no composting police, and when there is, I'm willing to be arrested over creating compost. So, because I think that's really funny, and I'll get the press to cover it. That's my direct action. That's my nonviolent direct action, is making one of them is making compost. It's illegal on a couple different points. I'm going to get to it at the end, but hold that question because I want to come back to it. So think big. And right now, here's some goat bedding that's being composted down in thermophilic piles, which are very hot piles compared to cool piles that most of you probably deal with when you throw things in the back of your yard and let them just sit there for a while. So, you know, if you look in a dumpster, you usually see something like this. This is outside of a Carrefour in Warsaw, Poland. This could be anywhere, but you'll notice that the writing's in Polish. And in some cases, there's some Italian there too. But anyway, this is what we usually throw out. It's pretty mixed. It's pretty crazy. Erlene knows about this. It's nuts what we go in there. And I really think we need to get in there and do it. So the amazing thing is I go into this dumpster because I was hired by these people in Warsaw last year to help them build a community composting operation. And I'm looking in this dumpster behind this grocery store less than 24 hours of landing in Warsaw, and this guy joins me. And it was just amazing. So I'm like, do you want me to get it for you? And he's like, no, he's just like, I don't speak any Polish. I speak Spanish and some French. And so I'm like, do you want me to get it for you? Because it's what I have. And he could see that I felt like I was like so much more able-bodied than he was. And then he had this cane, and he was just like plucking the choicest pieces out. And it's sticking them in a box and walking away. And I saw this guy several times. There was a great scavenger economy going on in Warsaw. It's like, I think it goes back to the communist times. Like most people wouldn't think about wasting things. And there's a bunch of old people doing this because they're gleaners, man. They come from a communist background and they're poor and they will glean. It was just, Warsaw was probably as melancholy as the Polish were. It was probably one of the brightest things that happened to me last year was being in Poland. I just thought they were just amazing, amazing, tenacious as anything, people. Wow. So you get in your dumpster and you pull this stuff out. And mostly I pull this stuff out because I think it's a crime to have these things. And sometimes when you pull things out, they fall out of your truck and you have this crazy mess. And it takes some time to go through this stuff, as Arlene knows also, or anybody who composts goes through garbage, and you have to sort through what's there, and it's really gooey mess. And that's the other thing. Bioremediation is the gooey mess of what's inside of us as people. It's a gooey mess outside of us, as above, so below, as within, so without. So it's really what I'm dealing with is kind of my own. It's kind of a little therapeutic. It's kind of exemplary of what's happening all around me. And I want to engage that. And there's something alchemical. There's like a magic trick about taking that stuff and doing that. And the public performance of going in a dumpster. It's pretty amazing. So who's been in a dumpster in the past month? Anybody? Okay, great. Okay. So this is a project I did with Michael Webb. Anybody know Michael Webb? He used to work at Inspiration Kitchens in Garfield Park. And so he's building on top of, it's a mulch site, very likely contaminated. People have been in Garfield Park for a very long time. There's industries threaded through that neighborhood. You have got both train lines. A lot of light industry has been there since the 1880s. I mean, it's pretty intense contamination. Just assume it because you live here. Assume it. Even if you do yoga and eat organic food, body is filtering the contamination in your environment. And that's just our starting point. So he built up, and he built up with like all his organic material he had. It was a drought last year. Very little of it started breaking down. And so one of the things that I did with him, I said, let's go deeper. And so what we did, we put tons of cardboard tubes all through these, what he was hopefully going to plant in this year. We put all these cardboard tubes with holes in them to get their compost teas down into these substrates and try to break them down a little faster. Because I said, I'm going to pile it up. And I said, okay, great. And I'm going to break it down faster because we need to break this down faster.
Radio EcoShock.
This is a Radio EcoShock recording of a speech by direct soil activist Nancy Clem at the Chicago Bioneers.
Here's a compost pile with a lot of carbons. Carbons can be many things because compost is carbon and nitrogen coming together. So I have straw. I have, the copious amounts of phone books that are dropped in my neighborhood that none of my neighbors pick up and then just like sit there for like months and eventually start growing mold on them. And it's really crazy. And so I just walk down the street, clean up my street of phone books, and I compost them all. So the idea is don't be shy, don't be small. Grab stuff. And one of the hindrances to composting is hauling. Hauling means basically taking material from one place to another. And so you can't take things from one place to another. That's something that I disobey. That's my direct action. Nonviolent direct action is carrying garbage that I found from one place to another so I can make it into compost. So the compost that I build is big. I'm working about 30 cubic yards by myself, and this is just really simple action. I build it really carefully. The compost is only as good as the ingredients you put into it, and really understand that. And so you can make a nutrient-dense compost as much as you can make a nutrient-dense stew. Compost making is really closer to like mole making or like stew than science. I really think it's more about cooking, and it's more inspired and poetic.
This is a Radio EcoShock recording of a speech by direct soil activist Nancy Clem at the Chicago Bioneers. Stay tuned for more, plus hot new music.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Welcome back. We return to a dirty speech about bioremediation. It's Nancy Clem at the Chicago Bioneers 2013.
I don't paint, but I draw. I'm a sculptor too, but I get a lot of like color combinations out of rotten food. Like they're better. It's like, you know, you can look at butterflies and flowers, and then you can look at like compost mess, and it can be just as fabulous in terms of textures and colors. So I get a lot of like artistic inspiration where I shoot a lot of pictures of rotten food. And it's actually really beautiful stuff. Anyway, so this is what I call going bigger, and it's sideways, but this is where I went into a community garden, El Parquito in Humboldt, and I said, I want to work with you guys because I saw a dry toilet on their garden side. I practically fell off my bike. I'm like, man, I got to work with these guys because if they're rocking the dry toilet, they know where it's at. So we're making a big cut. You guys, we'll get to the toilet thing if you haven't known what I do already. But anyway, we wanted to make something bigger. So they had all these crazy like wooden boxes everywhere, 8 different compost piles going on, and they were all dried out. And when you stuck a shovel into there, rats would just fly out of them. I mean, as a compost, you don't want smell and you don't want rats because those are nuisances. And you could get fined for that. And compost operations, professional compost operations get shut down because of the nuisance of smell. So I'm really good at it never smelling. Really, really good at that. Because I do compost my human waste in the city, in little village, in a dense neighborhood. So you got to be stealth, which means you got to be good at this stuff. And so it's not about knowing it, it's about doing it well. So it's really about reskilling as much as we're getting the word out in solidarity. I will also be arrested for dry toileting in the city. I'm ready to do that time for that crime. So this is something where we worked as a group. We worked to develop 15 cubic yard capacity for this site. That is beyond the legal capacity you're able to build at a community garden. We have a small bin where people are invited in Spanish and English to drop, to take their waste from the neighborhood. And then I go in there, or one of the Parquitoans I'm training in composting, we take it from that initial sloppy dump site and then layer it really well. It's a great garden site. 3 lots in Humboldt Park. So micro remediation is working with microbes. Does anybody recognize this one? Yes, it is E. coli, which you should know exists inside of our bodies. It's very important outside of our bodies because it helps us make vitamin K, which allows our blood to clot, which is a really good thing. But when it leaves our body, we want to make sure it gets digested quickly or gets killed off by heat or something happens. So protozoa also. So when we're building our compost, we are feeding these guys in our soil. All this life is basically, and you've heard it before, you heard it really strongly from Albert Bates this morning, are these things that are building our soil and keeping it alive and keeping it spacious and able to absorb water and giving nutrients to our food. And so nematodes, also great. There's beneficial and there's predatory and there's non-beneficials. So these guys you might also find yourself working with. If you have a problem in your garden, you might find yourself buying some dried nematodes and getting a couple tens of thousands and getting them into your soil. But the point is, part of bioremediation is working with microbes. How do you know who you're working with? Make really good compost. Be sure of your ingredients you're putting in there, that they're really clean. They're really diverse, like mole, with as many ingredients as possible. And just assume that you're producing really good life. And make sure it doesn't go anaerobic, which means it loses its oxygen because it's going to go bad. And we know what these are, besides mushrooms. So these are inky caps. And inky caps have a fondness for poop. And they're very, very common. And they come up really clean and they kind of fall apart. And they kind of parasol open. They just turn into this black inky mess. Do you know about these, Esmeraldo? Another dry toileter in the crowd, Esmeraldo. There's also mycoremediation, or working with fungus. And so when I showed that other pile with the straw and the newspaper and the wood chips, by introducing those wood lignans, which is what kind of the starchy protein of a tree or a shrub, by introducing that, you're really encouraging fungi to come in there because it's a lot of food for them, and they're really going to love it. I mean, they love all carbons, but they really will chow down on wood. So I always incorporate a little bit of wood into my compost to increase the fungal mass. So I just want to show you, this is a little bit hard to see. I went to the Radical Mycology Convergence in Port Townsend. This is a hand washing sink. So one of the other things in bioremediation is returning our sources back to it. So it really is talking about water. How do we get water into our landscapes instead of using it as a flush material or a waste material and trying to pour thousands of dollars into that? So how do we do that? And the way we do it is by these really simple creations. So this is a hand washing sink, and then they're getting well water. You're washing your hands. It goes down into the buckets below. And they're just explaining this is going to take some maintenance. Bioremediation takes involvement. It's really about easing into the grubby part. So it says, gray water bucket system, when full, please empty in the wood chip pile behind the sink. It's a very simple sink to set up. We were able to set it up in the middle of this woods, of a very delicate woods, and it was kind of like everybody has to chip in moving that wastewater to a place where it actually can be absorbed. This is me in Portland working at Planet Repair, which is, did I come last year and see Mark Lakeman? So I work with Mark Lakeman periodically in Portland, and he does city repair. He's a permaculture person. He does a lot of teaching on permaculture. And so they already have a rain catchment system. So this is not one rain barrel. This is actually a very small house with a very small roof space. And they have those drums, and they also have an overflow from that drum that goes into their garden. But what we were doing is we were actually taking the laundry and the sink water from the bathroom. We couldn't tap the shower, and we're running it out alongside the back of the house by the neighbors and trenching it through the garden so it would slowly filter into that growing space. So a lot of bioremediation is just like, how do we, instead of flush our waste or make it go away, how do we retain it within our living scapes? And you have to think about back in city formation, back in the medieval times, everybody had their home, they had their animals, they had their kitchen gardens, and everything was in the same compound. So they had to deal with their waste. They had to deal with their animals' waste, they had to deal with their kitchen waste. Everything was interconnected. And then that started breaking apart. We had those things, and then we had some common lands. We might have done it like a certain part of town when all that was happening, and then you go back to your house. And pretty soon that got relegated to the countryside. We get these systems where we take in the resources of the countryside, and our product to the countryside is waste. All our junk leaves Chicago. It really does. It leaves Chicago, goes downstream, goes out to the suburbs, gets processed, etc. So bioremediation is like leaning into the junk, getting back in there. And so I led this two-day workshop where we literally absorbed the gray water, the wastewater, from sink and laundry in this building. The other piece we did there as part of this workshop, we did a wetland that was going to help filter some wastewater from the kitchen sink, which is considered a dark gray water because it has particulates in it from food, meaning bacteria can grow a little bit faster than it, and not a bacteria you want, because gray water is not something you want to be in contact with. So this is what it looked like after we did the gray water outside, and we made this little cute walkway for the peas on one side, and the filtration is all towards the peas in this garden, and then we had overflow to the very, very ends. But we made that little platform so we didn't squish any of the piping that we had to bury underground. We didn't compact it or to break it. So, you know, gray water is like, as soon as you do all this work, no one sees it, no one knows what you're doing. I also have gray watered my house. This is kind of how it looks. It's not like, how would you know that was even happening? So soaps are entirely important. And Dill Pickle Co-op now carries soap and laundry detergent that's for gray water use, because I lobbied them so hard and I ran this water class and I made all my students call them, and now they carry it because they're a grocery store that actually responds to what you want. Compared to like Whole Foods, they're like, oh, we can't get that. I'm like, oh, really? You can't? You guys? They'll get it for you. So you go to the Dill Pickle Co-op if you want to start working with some gray water. A lot of plumbing comes into this, but you don't have to be an expert. But this is us, kind of Mark and Hannah. We're rerouting the plumbing on the side of the house. You can see how tight it is. They have this crazy wood pile over here that they build with. It's a crazy pileup of space. You really want to get it really close to the building, so it'll take some work. The inside guts of the water filter was PVC and some window work. I'm just showing us building it out. And that apparatus set, I can't go into too much, but that set on the bottom, and we were able to plant some reeds and some lobelia, which is a medicinal plant, to planted some nettles in there that could really help filter that water. As it went through this biological filter, it got cleaned and came out the other side. Not drinkable, but something that's much cleaner that you could be physical contact with and that we could water plants with. So it came out of the house with bacteria, unsafe, soil microbes, bacteria, and other stuff in there, eat it up, and it comes out much cleaner. This constructed wetland is almost like just another opportunity for growing. Like, you don't have a pond in your yard, do a constructed wetland. You can start growing some water-loving plants. You could do wild rice. You could do watercress, all sorts of things off that. A month later, I went back to Portland, and this is what it looked like. So I wear the clothes that go into my laundry, that go through that. I trust the soil. I made the soil, the compost that went into there, so I trust it. It's only me. I would not serve that to anybody else, because everybody has their own level of comfort, which is maybe why certain people left the room. So here we're back in Portland, the second time I was there. And what they did is they took up the entire driveway, okay? And you see the driveway in chunks everywhere. It's called urbanite. They took up the driveway, and they're turning it into a garden. This compaction on the soil, in a day, it did not, when we did a percolation test, like poured a bunch of water into a hole that we dug in this thing, it didn't drop an inch in a day. It was crazy. I went in the next morning, and it hadn't even dropped. We had the ruler stuck in there and everything. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is so compacted. So we had to really, really remediate the soil so the microbes can receive what gift they're being given from the sky, from the runoff down the street, from your house. So let's get this biologically active. This is a not biologically active piece of land that they want to turn into a thriving food forest, formerly known as their driveway, right? So what it takes some time is, like, here's the plumbing side. You get in there. You get into that oogie, disgusting place, and it's really uncomfortable. And I actually curse this job so many times because Portland, it's legal to do gray water. And so since it's legal, you have to build it to code. Okay, so I'm used to doing gorilla gray water, you know? But I also know how to build to code and what you have to do, which means a lot more plastic parts, a lot more valves, a lot more stuff. But the thing is, if you build it to code and you take a picture of it and you send it down to the city officials, it's another sane working example of what they just recently passed. And it's a sane working example. So in like 25 years from now, when Chicago starts thinking about gray water, it's another example of what works. So you get in there and you start cutting things apart and you have to do things. I am not a plumber, but I know how to draw lines. I think about it as choreography because I'm not mechanical. Everything has to be kind of like a choreographic movement. So literally when I'm doing this, I'm like, okay, water. Okay. And then I measure that. and I run out to Home Depot and I lay everything down on the ground to make sure it works without getting glued together, and then I glue it all together. That's kind of how it goes. And it's goofy, but that's how I do it, and it works. So this is on the backside. We literally drilled into the house with a hammer drill, drilled out the side, built a filter, which is just beyond me. It's a small filter. It's a mechanical filter. And the overflow goes to these two very deep pits, which will be planted. And those deep pits are one-third indigenous soil, two-thirds compost. This is the beginning of their garden. This took all day because I was trying to teach everybody around there how to do this. This is a three-barrel water filtration system that I designed and built in Los Angeles. It's John Todd's living machine idea. So one barrel, this is just a demo, and I didn't do this film, so it's really chunky, but one barrel receives the water. There's a mechanical filter of gravel and sand. It goes through two biological filters filled with compost and plants, which are biologically active, making soil, increasing the microbe count. And then on the back side of this was our cleaner water. Although we were filling it with hose water, let's say this was connected on anything else. This was something that I built with a bunch of kids. It's infinitely expandable. I built a bunch of aquaponic systems for Heifer Project about, 18 years ago. And so this was just me kind of, okay, how do we make this work? And so this is something, I put it on a pallet so it can be jacked around and moved anywhere it needs to go in this neighborhood. A mobile filtration system that I built with a bunch of kids. So we're going back to the other thing we're returning. Again, it's all about the microbes. It's really about our soil is only as healthy as we make it, as we allow it to be. So this is one of the toilets at Radical Mycology Conference. And you can see it's pretty simple. It's a board. It's a toilet seat. on a straw bale. This was for urine only, for women. So here's straw, which is a carbon loaded with nitrogen. It's going to decompose and become soil. It's a really, really simple, elegant math. So I'm a provocateur. I'm glad you guys are still here. So working with fungus, this is the Northwest. You just go out for a foray. Five people went out for about an hour, and this is what they found. You see all sorts of things, maitake, reishi, porcinis. It's like it's all there. It's pretty amazing. Fungi is their friend. And so working with fungi is really, really important. Cleaning, because as they network out, they're not only grabbing nutrients, they're grabbing toxins. And just like microbes can eat and break things down, so can mushrooms. And they do, and everybody is acquainted with well-publicized Paul Stamets' work, where he thinks that mushrooms will save the world. I'm like, yeah, as long as they work with plants and soil microbes. And everything's hydrated well with, like, healthy water. But anyway, so mushrooms are really, really important. Does anybody know what this mushroom is? Shaggy mane, really common mushroom. So these are some mushrooms that you'll see in landscape or you could cultivate in landscape and not, like, let it run loose and take over your landscape. Shiitakes, delicious, really easy to grow, you guys. Yeah, we just had a mushroom workshop with your colleague. Did we go to that, the mushroom workshop? Oysters. This is something I don't allow into my landscape. This is something you kind of keep. I was actually doing this on the front porch, just some oysters on some coffee grounds, just at the very beginning as they're fruiting. I mean, seriously, this was like just under my mailbox on my front porch. I don't eat that many mushrooms, so I'm just learning about them more, and so I'm not as serious about experimenting with them, but I kind of now am. I'm committed to growing a lot of mushrooms because I bought some property with a lot of forest on it. So I'm committed to getting down with the mushrooms better than I have been. This is at the convergence, and what they're doing is they're packing mushrooms and substrate into layered boxes, cardboard boxes, and then burying them in a garden to help inoculate the entire garden space with mushrooms. Now, this isn't just mushrooms. It's going to be for annual vegetables, but they're trying to link all those, that area together with the mycelium. The plant, does anybody recognize the plant right outside this garden? Nobody's gardeners here. Oh, my gosh. Okay, you guys must be really lost. That's comfrey. And comfrey holds a lot of phosphorus, a lot of potassium. It's one of the best things to throw into a compost pile, one of the best things to throw into a compost tea. Biodynamic, people use it. I use it. It's also really good human medicinal. So the fact that comfrey is working right there is you can be assured there's enough phosphorus and potassium in the soil right next to it. Because the mycelium, as they grow, they're going to feed on that cardboard. It's going to be a home for them because corrugated is this perfect, just like we saw biochar, this is a specific inoculation. So they're going to harvest vegetables from here and bluets. This is bluets that they were doing. So this is something you can release into a landscape. You got to be careful in a place like this when you have so many wild mushrooms that you don't release something. In Chicago, you're like, if I release a plague of this certain mushroom, if I release oysters into the Chicago environment, is it really going to be a problem? Probably not. An ecological problem? Probably not, right? Especially with what mushrooms are able to eat oil. So it's like it actually might be a benefit. So we might want that unleashed into our environment. But in this case, when you're on a forest, you'd be really careful about what you're putting into the ground. So you want to use things that are not going to get invasive or prolific or beat out indigenous or natural mushrooms that already live there. These guys also didn't pull any soil in. All they did is sheet mulch their soil level up. So they were away from the contaminated soil, and they sheet mulched up. So their site is actually about 2 foot or so higher than the street, and it kind of amps down. Just showing use of cardboard. This is mulch, so it's going to keep the weeds out, but it also what it's doing is it can promote mushroom growth. So if you did inoculate with mushrooms here, you could have that dual species and that nutrient interaction. Third tool of bioremediation are plants. So again, what's happening here, the train tracks are healing themselves. This soil is healing itself. This is in Philadelphia. This will never be the High Line or the 606, or the Bloomingdale Trail. This is like you have to get you. This is kind of the Bloomingdale Trail used to be something you had to, like, you could just go up there and just walk around. It was this beautiful wild place. Now it's You know, now it's like hyper-politicized and very, it's going to be tamed. But they haven't thought about toilets yet. They don't know how they're going to do comfort stations up there. And I'm like, oh, that's so interesting. And they're bringing life back into the soil. And that soil is actually detoxified and getting better. So a lot of bioremediation is just let land do what it does, which we have a hard time doing. Anybody who's like an avid gardener, it's hard not to garden. So again, these Philadelphia and Baltimore are great to work in because there's so much of this happening. And that big plant coming out of there is sunflower. Sunflower is one of the great accumulators of lead and into its own body. It's almost like a sacrifice unto itself. It takes it into its own body and becomes that. So when you go into a landscape, especially one with spontaneous vegetation, you can read that landscape and you can probably tell when the last time it's been disturbed. You can probably tell the pH. You can probably tell what nutrients you have on land and nutrients you're deficient on. You can read the landscape. And we used to be able to do that as people. And since I was just hanging out with a bunch of indigenous people, it was amazing because that's what we did. We went out to land and we read it together because I grew up like that. These people know how to do that. This is something we need to learn. How do you look at a site and think about, is this safe for my child to play on, my dog to run through, since dogs have, and all animals have, very close contact with the soil, and then we have close contact with them when we pick them up or snuggle with them. So really, they can be transference of these things. What's happening in our environment? You can literally go around and have it reads like a book. And you can get to know, and plants are easy because they're so knowable as opposed to the microbes, right? It's easy to study plants. Start learning your spontaneous vegetation. Duckweed is great. This is something that cleans our waters. I'm just going to run through some plants. A little bit easier to recognize. Algaes, huge. Microscopic algaes in compost. Also our water algaes. This algae, people call this seaweed. I hear people, oh, I got a bunch of seaweed. I went swimming. And I was like, okay. So algaes are great. Water hyacinths, tropical plant, not native to our place, but people are working with hydroponics or might know about this. This is something that cleans the soil. People make baskets. You see baskets at, like, what are those, World Market, and, you know, Pier 1 has baskets made out of this plant. This is a plant when I was in Mexico that we composted, and we also dried this and burned this. Did you ever do this? Cools it. It holds fire for a while. So it's a really good quick fuel plant. And this is something that's choking waterways in certain areas, and you could just harvest it off as long as you can suspect it's clean and compost it. Or if you're working indoors, this will take over a pond in the summer in Chicago. Sunflowers, alpine pennycress, really, really important. There's so many things related to it. You've probably seen this. You're like, oh, that looks like mustard. It looks like poor man's pepper. It looks like peppergrass. It looks like, you know, field cress. Like, you've seen something like this. Might have a little yellow flower or little white flowers. Can be a green manure, but it's also really good at accumulating and extracting from soil, breaking things down, taking it on inside of its own body. Perennial plants. We showed you annual plants. Perennial plants, too. Lots of grasses. This is bent grass. There's a lot of grasses. They're doing a lot of work with fescues and bent grass. I just want to make a point with all this. The fecund, or the vitality, is really linked to this rotting world, to this fetidness. But it's a clean kind of rot that I'm talking about, you know? And I really think of when we start realizing that our life is based on rotting things, we are closer to mushrooms than we are to plants in terms of how we biologically function, and mushrooms are big decomposers. I really want us to think about this a little bit. Realize that maybe what we have to do is, like, delve into that depth, go into that dirty space, and what does that mean? And thank you.
It is hard to face up to our waste products, isn't it? To gather up the goo and turn it into soil for city gardens? It's called bioremediation, returning landscapes to natural production using plants. Our guide is Nancy Clem from spontaneousvegetation.net. Her latest project is called The Ground Rules. They gather organic waste from business to create compost and soil for the cities. The name is spelled N-A-N-C-E. K-L-E-H-M, Nancy Clem. Find links to Nancy and her works in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Again, my thanks to Kelly Pierce of the Chicago Independent Media Center for this Radio EcoShock recording. Our closing song was created by Toronto-based singer, rapper, filmmaker, and activist Gaisi. That's Gaia Isi. There is an astounding video for this music, which you have to see. It's the best of free footage donated by Project Collaborators 350.org, Climate Reality, Greenpeace, the Rainforest Action Network, and WWF. Here is Change the Earth by Gaisi.
Take for the occasion, for it caves in, embrace, we better.